Well, good morning and welcome all back. As a first speaker for today, we have Jan de Boer, who will continue his talk on string theory and non-perturbative gauge theory.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great pleasure to continue this lecture. It's not quite such a great pleasure to do that this morning at 9 o'clock, because, well, this town has a few distractions too many somehow. So in any case, today I want to continue the discussion of supersymmetric gauge theories, and in particular use string theory to try to say something non-trivial about these things. So the last time, I basically just discussed pure n equals one theories in four dimensions and some of the non-perturbative dynamics that took place and what sort of tools one can have to study those things. So today I'm going to look at a somewhat larger class of theories, which is a certain class of n equals one theories that you get from n equals two theories by breaking them to n equals one by adding a superpotential. So from the n equals one point of view, an n equals two theory contains of a n equals one vector multiplet of the type we have been considering in the previous lecture. And in addition, an n equals two theory contains an n equals one adjoint scalar field capital phi. Now, the idea of this class of theories, it's just some generic class of theories, is to simply add to the theory a three-level superpotential, which is a sum of traces of powers of phi. So this is just a simple polynomial superpotential. And if you add that to the n equals two theory, one gets an n equals one theory, and that n equals one theory we're going to study. So what are the classical vacuum of this theory? Well, as I explained last time, if you want to have a classical vacuum of such a supersymmetric gauge theory, what you need is you need to look at extrema of the superpotential, or in other words, at zeros of W prime. Well, W prime, since W is a polynomial, W prime can just be written as a product of factors phi minus pi. And clearly, in order to have a supersymmetric state, what we need to do is we need to make sure that phi, which can always be diagonalized using a gauge transformation, that phi needs to have eigenvalues which are all equal to one of the pi. That's how we choose a classical vacuum in the theory. So classical supersymmetric vacua of this theory are given by expectation values of phi of this form. Each of the eigenvalues is equal to one of the pi. Together, they form blocks. So there's n1 times the number p1, n2 times the number p2, and so on. And clearly, this breaks, again, classically, the U and gauge group to a product of U and I gauge groups. Each of the U and I's is the gauge group that preserves each of these blocks. So classically, the group UN is broken to a product of smaller U and I gauge groups. And if you think about what degrees of freedom are left, actually all the components of phi become massive in this way. So what we get at very low energies is just the product of pure U and I gauge theories. Now, last time, I tried to explain that if you have a pure U and I gauge theory, just then it's well described, perhaps, at low energies by this Feniziano-Jankelevich effect of action. So you expect that at very low energies, a good description of this theory is basically a sum of the Feniziano-Jankelevich effective actions for each of these U and I factors. Because at low energies, what we have is just a combination of pure U and I gauge groups. So the idea is that instead of having a single global field S, we now have different ones, one for each of these U and I gauge groups that classically was unbroken, and that the full low energy effective action somehow is going to be a sum of Feniziano-Jankelevich pieces, one for each of the U and I gauge groups. But that's of course not the full answer, because we started off with a UN theory and there are more degrees of freedom than just these S. There were more degrees of freedom. It was not just a combination of pure U and I n equals one theories. So in addition, we expect to find some additional piece. And the claim is that in these theories, the additional piece we're having is something that is perturbative. It's just some perturbative expression in terms of the SIs. The proof that this is indeed, if you want a good low energy effective action, or at least a good low energy effective superpotential, is not as crisp as perhaps it was in the case of pure n equals 1 theories. So for a pure n equals 1 theory, the calculation basically used this integrating in procedure. And in addition, it used an honest instanton calculation. And the combination of those two ingredients leads you to derive the Svenigiano-Yankelevich action. In this case, we have several fields Si. And of course, it would be nice to sort of repeat the same trick from last time, somehow do an honest instanton calculation, compute the expectation value of the superpotential at the extremum, and then to integrate in the fields Si again. However, that's not really possible because the fields Si don't couple to, in this theory, they don't couple to an obvious source. There's only the sum of all the Si's, which couples to lambda, as it did in a pure UN theory, but the individual SI don't couple to a source, so we cannot integrate them in a naive way. So that's one thing that makes this theory somewhat more complicated to understand. And there are some other things, but in any case, this is the claim, and there are various, various ways to verify this claim. So the proof that this is true is not completely 100% watertight. There are various subtleties. For instance, how are you going to, for instance, define in the full theory these fields Si? It's a priori not even clear how to really give a gauge invariant definition or something like that of the trace over U and I of W alpha W alpha, because U and I is embedded somehow in UN, and in order to give a gauge invariant definition of that procedure, that's a bit complicated. So, well, you can sort of go around that by writing this expression here. So this looks like a more gauge invariant definition of what these fields Si should be. So we write down the trace of W alpha W alpha, and one divides by Z minus phi, and there's a contour integral around one of these expectation values. So these pi were simply the classical expectation values. Now clearly, if you do that contour integral, then what you pick up is precisely only the piece of W alpha, which was in this block where phi was equal to pi, because the contour integral picks up this particular pole. So this superpotential W of Si, it has the right extrema one can show if you compute this perturbative piece using perturbation theory. So this has the right extrema that can be computed in other ways also. And this perturbative piece, there are several ways in which you can obtain it. You can obtain it using what's called the Konishi anomaly, which is some technique which I'm not going to explain, but it essentially uses field redefinitions in the theory, and it uses those field redefinitions. You can use those field redefinitions to derive all kinds of word identities, and using those word identities, you can then figure out what is W perturbative has to be. You can use matrix integrals to compute this perturbative part, and you can use Calabi-Yau geometry. And in some sense, these things are sort of closely related to each other. So this matrix approach, this Dijkgraaf-Hafner matrix approach, although that was originally derived using topological string theory, however, you can do it purely in field theory, because it turns out that if we want to do some perturbation theory, what we're interested in is just doing, you know, all kinds of diagrams that have W alpha external lines with suitable indices and so on. So in some sense, all that one wants to do in field theory is sort of sum over all such diagrams with W alpha external lines. And it turns out that there is a sort of nice way in field theory to do this. And if you study that in more detail, you find that all these field theory diagrams have a remarkable property that they precisely, that all the momentum integrals, they sort of cancel out. And if you just study such diagrams in the gauge theory, you find that they reduce to matrix integrals. So in that way, you can give, if you want, a pure field theoretic proof of the fact that all these diagrams are computed by matrix integrals and that therefore the perturbative part in this action are computed by matrix integrals. And the recipe is to take the matrix integral whose action is simply the classical superpotential of the theory. Then if you have this matrix integral, I'm just sketching this because I'm not going to use this in the rest. What you're going to do is you're going to write down planar diagrams in this theory. So you can, it's only the planar diagrams of this matrix model that contribute. And these planar diagrams, they typically, well, let's see, in double line notation. So if you want to do planar diagrams for such theories, you typically use this double line notation. This is a matrix valued field. And for a matrix valued field, it's always easy to write a propagator using double lines, where one of the lines is one of the indices of the matrix, and the other line is the other index of the matrix. And then the planar diagram is precisely a diagram like this Mercedes-Benz diagram, where lines do not cross. And now since each of these closed lines is an indexed loop, you get for each of the closed lines, you get some factor of n, I, depending on in which u and I this particular indexed loop is running. So such a diagram will give rise to a certain power of this coupling in front. And in addition, there will be some powers of ni coming from just depending on exactly what is running in what loop. And then you get basically, if you sum all these planar diagrams, you get some coefficients times powers of the gauge of this coupling in front times products of factors of ni. So this is just by doing the planar diagram expansion of this matrix theory, expanded around a particular classical saddle point. And one of the classical saddle points of this integral is precisely taking, again, M equal to a diagonal matrix whose eigenvalues are combinations of the PIs, the zeros of W prime. And you can simply sum those diagrams. And this gives you, then what you then finally have to do is a simple recipe. Namely, what you have to do is you have to replace G and I by S I. So this is rather peculiar. This is a rather formal replacement. But this is what comes out of the recipe. You just have to replace the integers N I. You just have to replace them formally by the field S I. And if you do that, you sum all these planar diagrams, then you get the perturbative expansion of this perturbative contribution in WSI. So that's how you do these matrix integrals just sketched how it works. What's interesting by itself is also whether or not these matrix integrals by themselves, so whether in some sense they are a good complete non-perturbative definition of this theory in some sense. That's much less clear. These matrix integrals, they're quite tricky to define because typically what you have is you have polynomials of your functions of M here which are unbounded. So as it stands, these integrals really don't make any sense. And in order to really define these integrals, you have to move away in the complex plane. So in principle, there are Hermitian matrices here, but doing this integral over Hermitian matrices is not a well-defined integral. In order to do this in a well-defined way, you have to move away in the complex plane. You have to choose suitable contours. So that is, becomes a convergent expression. And then you have to, and there are many different contours, so there are many different non-perturbative answers for this integral. This integral does not have a single answer. And then you have to think hard whether or not that full non-perturbative answer has anything to do with gauge theory. So that's not clear at all. It's really, at this level, this is just a generating function that generates for you the perturbation theory of the field theory, whether the full non-perturbative matrix integral is in some sense related to gauge theory is not clear at all. Are there any questions? Okay. So what I would now like to do is to describe how you can get some of these results for these gauge theories using brain constructions. And the brain constructions will be of the following type. So this goes back to a construction that first was found by Witten. You can engineer gauge theories in string theory in various different ways. But this is a particularly nice one because this does not require any complicated geometry. No complicated Calabi-Yau or things like that, or toric geometry or so. It just uses flat space and you just put some brains in flat space. So if you want to make a pure N=2 theory, what you do is you take two NS5 brains and you stretch some D4 brains between them. And D4 brains can end on NS5 brains in string theory, so this is a construction that you can do. And in this construction, the NS5 brains are wrapped in the 0, 1, 2, 3 direction. That's the four-dimensional direction in which the field theory will live. They're suppressed in this picture. In addition, these NS5 brains, they have two more coordinates, which is the X4 and the X5 direction, which are drawn here. And then these D4 brains, they live in the 0, 1, 2, 3, and in the 6 direction. And the 6 direction goes from left to right. So the claim is that if you look at this theory, at this system, and you look at the theory on the D4 brains, then the claim is that at low energies, these D4 brains support a pure N=2 UN gauge theory. These D4 brains, they are really five-dimensional objects. So if we say that we find at low energies an N=2 theory in four dimensions, what we really mean is, of course, that the energy is so low that we don't see this extra fifth dimension. So it's only true for wavelengths that are longer than the distance between the two NS5 brains. So I don't have time to explain exactly why this is an N=2 UN theory. It's quite easy to count the number of supersymmetries that survives to see that it's N=2. To see that you get just a pure N=2 theory is slightly more complicated because you have to study the boundary conditions of fields on the D4 brain when they end on an NS5 brain, which is a somewhat more complicated analysis. Yeah, so this is the classical picture. So the locations of the D4 brains, they correspond precisely to the fact that an N=2 theory has a Coulomb branch. So if the D4 brains are separated, the gauge theory is actually, it's somewhere on the Coulomb branch. The Coulomb branch is the, let me briefly say what that is for those that don't know. So if you have an N=2 theory that has this adjoint scalar field phi, so it has a vector supermultiplet in this scalar field, and the scalar field you can always choose diagonal using a gauge transformation. If you're interested, you can choose a diagonal if you're interested in a supersymmetric ground state of the theory. In this previous case, I had to require that these phis, that they satisfied W prime phi I is zero for a supersymmetric thing, but now we don't have a three-level superpotential. So these phi I are arbitrary, and the phi I, they parameterize a moduli space, D-space of supersymmetric vacua of the theory. And these phi i's are just complex numbers. And these phi i's, they are simply, in this picture, they are simply the location of the D4 brain as it ends on the NS5 brain. So as you vary the phi I, that simply amounts to moving this D4 brains around on the NS5 brain. And if two of them coincide, then from this point of view, it just means that some of the eigenvalues coincide. And that's a point where you have a non-abelian enhanced gauge symmetry. Because for generic expectation values of the phi I, the gauge group is broken to U1 to the n. So that's, in that sense, this brain picture gives you a very simple picture of this Coulomb branch, and just these brains moving around. That's not so special, so this is what I just explained. So this is just a classical picture, so what we really want to do, think about is the full quantum gauge theory. So how can you think about the quantum gauge theory? So there's this following beautiful procedure. In order to get the quantum gauge theory, all you need to do is to lift this configuration to M theory. So if you lift this brain configuration to M theory, then an extra circle appears, namely the 11th direction, which has a certain radius R. And we know that if we lift D4 and NS5 brains to M theory, they will just become brains. Both will become an M5 brain in M theory. The only difference is whether or not the D4, the brain is wrapped on the extra 11-dimensional circle. So a D4 brain, when you lift it, becomes an M5 brain wrapped on the circle. The NS5 brain, when you lift it, becomes an M5 brain not wrapped on the circle. So once you lift this, you get a single M5 brain configuration. And in order to preserve supersymmetry, this has to be a, you can show this has to be a holomorphic configuration. So this has to be some holomorphic surface. The four dimensions in which the gauge theory lives are not affected by lifting to M theory, but the other directions are. And before, these D4 brains and NS5 brains, they were wrapped in the directions 4, 5, and 6. Now we get this extra direction, X10. And in order to write down an equation for a holomorphic brain configuration, we need to choose some holomorphic coordinates. Well, one holomorphic coordinate is rather easy to choose. It is just a combination of X4 and X5. But for the other coordinate, you usually take this combination, the exponent of minus x6 plus I x10 divided by r, because this is a good single-valued coordinate on the cylinder. If you combine the 6 and the 10 direction, they of course form a cylinder, and a nice holomorphic coordinate to write down on the cylinder is simply this combination t. You could of course also work with xx plus I x10 divided by r, but that would not be single valued. So then you have to worry all the time whether everything you write down is periodic in x10. But if you write everything in terms of t, then it will be obviously periodic in x10. So this is a much more convenient thing to do. So what you want to do now, if you want to lift this to M theory and you want to have a supersymmetric configuration, you need to find some sort of holomorphic surface that describes this M5 brain. So what are the sort of things one needs to do? Well, we have two NS5 brains and we had N D4 brains. So one way to get an idea of the sort of equation we expect to find is by trying to get an idea of the degree of this equation. So we have two complex coordinates. So we would naively think that this configuration is described by a single function of these two coordinates being equal to zero. So what could be the properties? Well, if you first of all, if you take t constant, so t constant means intersecting this configuration in this way, and then we see that it intersects this brain configuration in n different points, namely once every D4 brain location. So we expect this equation to have the property that when t is constant, that it has n solutions. What's also true is that if we take V constant, which is intersecting it in this way, then we expect the equation to have two solutions, because those two intersections are the two NS5 brains that we had. Therefore, we expect something that's going to be of order 2 in T and of order N in V. And then, well, you can write down a simple polynomial equation that is indeed of order 2 in T and of order N in V. This is not the most general equation of that type that you can find, but if you then also impose some boundary conditions, then you've and use the freedom to redefine coordinates and so on, then at the end of the day, what you have is that this pretty much is the unique equation that can possibly describe this surface and that has these properties. So this equation here, this nth order polynomial contains this polynomial Pn, and this Pn is simply a very convenient way to keep track of all these values phi I. So P and V, I'll use this black one. this Pn of V is just the product of V minus phi I of these eigenvalues. Because actually, these eigenvalues, they are not really, they don't really honestly parameterize the set of supersymmetric vacua of the theory. Because once you choose phi diagonal, you have not broken the complete gauge symmetry. You still have, if you look at the residual gauge group that remains, then it turns out, as you can easily see, is that the permutation group, which is a subgroup of U and the permutation group, still preserves this diagonal configuration. So you can just permute all these phi I using a gauge transformation. Therefore, the phi I are not really gauge invariant coordinates on your moduli space of supersymmetric vacua. But the coefficients in this polynomial Pn, they are all symmetric polynomials in the phi I. And those symmetric polynomials are obviously invariant under permutations. And they are therefore, they are good coordinates to parameterize the space of supersymmetric vacua of the theory. So in this way, we get this equation here. This describes a Riemann surface. And this is the famous Seiberg-Witten curve, the Riemann surface that solves the low energy effective field theory of n equals 2 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. So this is how you see that emerge from this simple brain picture. So in the solution, in the original solution of Seiberg and Witten, this was just an auxiliary description. But here it actually has a more direct meaning. It is really a geometric surface on which we wrap the M5 brain. So the 2,0 theory on the M5 brain. The M5 brain is a six-dimensional theory. This six-dimensional theory that lives on the M5 brain is a theory from the six-dimensional point of view has 2,0 supersymmetry. And so the claim is that if you reduce that over, if you do a sort of Kaluza-Klein reduction over this Riemann surface, then the claim is that what you're left with at the end of the day is a low-energy effective theory of quantum n equals 2 super Yang-Mills, which is sometimes called MQCD. The reason that this is sometimes called MQCD, or the M is obviously because we used M theory, but the other feature of this theory is that it's not really QCD, because you can see that in this theory, at the scale lambda QCD, at the dynamical scale of the theory, there are additional degrees of freedom beyond those of the field theory. So this is a theory that has more degrees of freedom than ordinary QCD. However, as is often the case, that doesn't really matter as long as you focus on BPS quantities. If you are only interested in computing quantities that are BPS, then the difference between the theories can be ignored. But you can explicitly check that if you compute a non-BPS quantity, for instance, if you compute a higher order derivative term in the low energy effective action, you can just do the calculation in both in the M5 brain theory and in the field theory, and you can see that the answers disagree in a quite dramatic way. So for BPS quantities, it's fine. And that's why this is a very useful tool. And for some other things that you can get, so this is not so important, but one of the other physical quantities one can get from this construction is, for instance, the low energy gauge couplings. Those you get roughly in the following way. So the six-dimensional theory living on this M5 brain, one of its essential degrees of freedom is a self-dual two-form. In six dimensions, one can have self-dual two-forms. And if you decompose the two-form in six dimensions in terms of a set of holomorphic one-forms on this Riemann surface times four-dimensional gauge fields, then you can insert this into the M5 brain action, do the Kaluza-Klein reduction, and then one finds that the kinetic term of these Bs gives rise to ordinary Yang-Mills actions for the U1 gauge fields A mu. And the gauge coupling that appears in front is obviously related to some geometric property of these one forms omega I. And they're given simply by integrating these omega I's around suitable one cycles on this Riemann surface. So this was just the n equals 2 theory. So now we want to do the same thing. We want to do the same sort of brain construction, but we want to do it for this more general class where we break n equals 2 to n equals 1. And a priori, you might think that it is rather strange because these n equals 1 theories, they have a superpotential, which is just an arbitrary polynomial. So how can we ever implement an arbitrary polynomial in terms of these brains? Well, it turns out that in order to add a superpotential, W of phi, what you can do is you can simply take one of the two NS5 brains and you can bend it. You can just bend it away from the other one in another direction. So if we are going to break supersymmetry even further down to n equals 1 in four dimensions, then one way to do it is to take a more complicated brain geometry. And so what you have to do is you have to take one of the NS5 brains. It's a bit difficult to draw, so I now sort of compressed the previous picture in a two-dimensional plane. So the NS5 brains are now, instead of planes, just straight lines. The D4 brains are some straight lines stretching between them. And then you have to imagine that is one of these two brains really moves out of the plane into the audience in some way. And this involves a new direction. And the new direction, we'll just take for that to be the 8 and 9 coordinate. So one of the two brains bends into this room in some way. And the way in which it bends is precisely given by the derivative of the superpotential. So V was a coordinate that went up along this NS5 brain. And to describe its bending in that direction, we simply use W prime of V. So W, this new coordinate that's going to be involved, is given by W prime of V, and that describes the curved brain configuration. So to verify that this indeed gives you this particular gauge theory, you can do various things. One thing you can do is you can look at the masses of open strings that stretch between the D4 and NS5 brains and see whether the masses of those open strings indeed grow like W prime of V, which is according to the classical gauge theory what they should do. So that works in fact fine, so that's good evidence that this works. Another thing one can try to see is what are now the classical supersymmetric configurations that one can have. To have a classical supersymmetric configuration, these D4 brains, they still have to lie only in the x6 direction, otherwise you break supersymmetry completely. You cannot just give them an arbitrary angle, that would break supersymmetry. So in order to have a supersymmetric configuration, they have to lie precisely in the x6 direction. And that you can only do, that is no longer trivial, because if I take this picture and if I rotate it by 90 degrees so that you get a side view, then the side view of this picture is that we have the old NS5 brain. We have one of the two NS5 brains, which we did not touch, it's still straight, but the other one we gave a certain profile in this W direction. So from the side, it looks like this. Now from this side view, D4 brains are lines that are orthogonal to the screen. So if you want to connect these two curves using D4 brains, using straight D4 brains, we can only do that at points where these things intersect. You know, we cannot do it here, so we can only do it here and here and so on and so on. So there's only a few discrete points where we can put the D4 brains in between. And these points where this happens, this is precisely where W prime of V is equal to zero. Because this curve was given by W prime of V, and it intersects the other one when it's equal to zero. Well, that's precisely consistent with what one gets in the classical field theory. Namely, these D4 brains only fit when this expectation value of phi, which parameterized the locations of the D4 brains, it only fits when they are equal to, when all these eigenvalues are again equal to some of the roots of the equation W prime of V equals zero. So this shows you that classically, this is a good way to engineer these broken theories, these theories that are broken to N equals one. They involve a straight and a wiggly five brain with some D4 brains stretched in between. So now we want to lift again this configuration to M theory and see if we can get a quantum dynamics of the theory out. So let's try to lift this configuration to M theory. So now the lift is more complicated. Previously, what we had was a single holomorphic curve in the complex directions T and V. So T on the bottom here. T on the bottom here was this coordinate involved this extra M theory circle. V was the 4-5 direction. But now an extra direction got involved, which is W. So now instead of having two complex coordinates, we have three complex coordinates, and we have to somehow describe a holomorphic Riemann surface embedded in these three complex coordinates. Well, one way in which one can do it is by writing this as two equations for three complex variables. And again, without going through all the details, the claim is that to describe this particular surface here, that's you just need two polynomial equations. And the two polynomial equations are given at the bottom here. One equation involves only W and V, and the other equation involves only T and V. So roughly what these two equations describe is the projection of this surface. One equation describes the projection in the VW plane, and the other equation describes the projection in the TV plane. So the equation in the WV plane is given by this equation here. So it involves the derivative of the superpotential, which is not so strange because classically W was equal to W prime V. And in the quantum theory, it is more, if you would forget the last term, it looks still more or less like that. But now there is an extra quantum correction, which is this little f here. So classically, this f was simply not there. Because if you look at this equation, then it has two solutions, W equals zero, which was the straight five brain. And the other solution is W is equal to two capital W prime, which was just this wiggly five brain. But in the quantum theory, this is all smoothed out. Everything gets connected, and that's reflected by this extra polynomial f that appears. And the other equation that we find is exactly the Cyber-Quitten curve again. It has not been modified. That's perhaps also not so surprising. If we forget this bending in the W direction of one of the two NS5 brains, if we just ignore it, then we haven't really done anything to the configuration. And therefore, it's perhaps not completely surprising that if you lift this, that as far as the T and V coordinate are concerned, you still get exactly the Cyber-Quitten curve and nothing else. So this is the geometry. One gets two quadratic equations that describe these two projections. It's, however, non-trivial for these equations to be compatible with each other. A priori, if you just write two equations like that and you intersect them, it could be a rather god-awful, in general, it could be a singular configuration. You really have to study what these equations are. And in order to describe a smooth Riemann surface with the right properties, these two equations have to satisfy certain compatibility conditions. If I just write a bunch of random junk here, it certainly will not give you a smooth configuration. So the compatibility of these two equations translates into two equations that are written here. So these look rather long. It doesn't really matter what they are. But what's important is that this is just a bunch of polynomial equations. There's this completely algebraic. So what you find is that roughly, if you look at the discriminant of the two quadratic equations, you know, if you would solve this quadratic equation using high school math, you find this square root somehow. The square root involves for one equation this combination and for the other equation this combination. And what you see here is that the square root, these discriminants of these two quadratic equations, they have to be of the form a square of a polynomial times something else. And but something else, the non-quadratic piece, has to be the same. And as long as this non-quadratic piece is the same, that roughly tells you that essentially these both describe the same surface. They have the same branch, they branch in the same way, they have the same structure of branch cuts as the other one. So they just have the same common set of branch cuts, and that means that they really together describe the single smooth Riemann surface. So the polynomials on the right-hand side here, this S, this H, the G, and this little F here, those are four a priori arbitrary polynomials. Now, if you look at these equations, so what was the input? The input was just this three-level superpotential W prime. So what we have here is this W prime, and then what the freedom that we have is we have to choose a polynomial capital P, which describes the eigenvalues of the phi I, of the capital phi, these phi I's. There's this polynomial F here, and then there's four other polynomials appearing. So there's lots of freedom, so you might think this is an, it's very easy to solve these equations, but if you simply count the number of equations and the number of free parameters, you see that there's exactly the same number of equations as free parameters. So this set of algebraic equations will just have, one would believe, a set of discrete solutions. So those discrete solutions then completely describe the location of the quantum vacua of this deformed theory. So this is a very, if you want, efficient way to find the quantum minima of the theory. And they're simply obtained by solving two algebraic equations. This is, in fact, much easier if you're interested in finding the supersymmetric minima of these theories. This is much easier, just using these equations, than solving some horrible matrix integral. Because if you do this, if you solve matrix theory completely, you don't get the minima, you get some low-energy effective superpotential, and you still have to extremize it to find the actual supersymmetric vacuum of the theory. And since it's not really possible to explicitly sum this planar perturbation theory, it's a, quite a complicated procedure to do it like that. But if you use this setup, you do not at this point get the supersymmetric, this full superpotential, but you do get, in a very easy way, the supersymmetric quantum minimum of the theory. And what's also nice is that these two different projections, so this theory, this Riemann surface has two projections, one in the WV plane and the other in the TV plane. These two projections both have a sort of simple meaning. Namely, if you just look at the TV plane, that was the Seiberg-Witten curve. So that's just really the Seiberg-Witten curve. So that is sort of the n equals 2 component of the theory. And if you look in the WV plane, then that quadratic equation turns out to be precisely the equation that appears when you do this matrix integral. If you solve these matrix integrals using sort of large n techniques, then you introduce eigenvalue densities of the form that Shiraz wrote down. And then if you look in the quantum in this theory, what happens at large n, then you also find that the solution of this theory is described by an auxiliary Riemann surface. And that Riemann surface describes the distribution of eigenvalues of this theory at large n. That Riemann surface that appears here, that is precisely the projection of this curve in the WV plane. So this simple M-theory curve unifies in a sort of funny way the matrix model curve, the Riemann surface describing the eigenvalue density of the matrix integral, with the Seiberg-Witten curve. It really somehow joins them in one single Riemann surface, which is where the M5 brain lives. And various gauge theory quantities get a very elegant interpretation in terms of some geometry of this Riemann surface. So there are two very natural differentials one can write down on this Riemann surface. One is the combination dt over t. And you can check, I really don't have time to explain this, but you can check that if you look at dt over t, this one form, and you expand it around v is equal to infinity, then it turns out that this thing generates all the expectation values of all powers of phi, simply by expanding this as a power series in 1 over v. Yeah, this combination is typically called the resolvent. So the resolvent of the gauge theory, which is this one form here, if you expand this around V equals infinity, then you see that it's just a power series that gives you all the expectation values of all powers of phi. So all these one-point functions of all these gauge invariant operators, they're simply contained in this single one form. And there's another one form, which is W times dV, another nice one form on the surface. And that gives you also a series of expectation values, but not of the gauge theory, but in fact, it gives you all the expectation values of this matrix model. Because again, you can verify, this takes quite a lot of work, but you can verify that indeed, if you expand W dV around V equals infinity, then all the coefficients in the expansion you find are precisely the expectation values of the powers of M, the matrix that appeared in the matrix integral. So this Riemann surface really knows about the gauge theory, and it also now knows about this matrix model, and it all is combined in one single structure somehow. And there are some more things to be said, namely, one of the interesting, there are some more properties. These two differentials that I just mentioned, dt over t and wdv, they satisfy various other relations. For instance, this Riemann surface has all kinds of natural one cycles. And if you integrate these differential forms over these one cycles, you get all kinds of other quantities. For instance, these integers ni that describe the classical breaking pattern of the gauge group, those integers ni are simply obtained by doing a contour integral of dt over d around some one cycle on this surface. And the si's, the expectation values of these global superfields, they're obtained by doing a contour integral of this other differential around certain one cycles. So all these gauge theory quantities, they're simply extracted by doing geometric operations. Good. So now, this describes the quantum vacua of this broken gauge theory. But it's an interesting question whether we can actually get this full superpotential and not just its minima. Of course, there is a lot of information in the minima, and perhaps in some sense, this is really all the information that is physically meaningful. Perhaps this whole large superpotential that one can write down has no information except the values of its minima. That's sort of the minimalistic, yeah? Yeah, so this, well, strictly speaking, they can differ by integers. One thing that, the contour, I'll come back to that later because it's an important point. The contour integrals of dt over t have to be integers a priori. Because dt over t, if you do a contour integral, it simply counts how often the Riemann surface wraps around the M-theory circle once you move around this one cycle. Now, this one cycle is mapped into this M-theory space, but it has this M-theory circle. And if you think about what this contour integral does, it just counts how often it winds around. So that has to be an integer. That's because t has this angular part in it. So it has to be an integer. So a priori, these contour integrals of dt over t, they have to be integers. However, it's not quite like that, because these B periods are non-compact. So sort of from this, perhaps this is a picture, so from this sort of branch cut picture of this Riemann surface, these A cycles go like that. And these B cycles, they go basically like that to infinity. Now, in order to do this infinite integral, you have to regulate it somehow. And to regulate it, there is some procedure to do that, but that gives you, for this cycle, gives you a certain outcome for this integral. Now you could say, well, if I do this one, I can get an arbitrary other answer, right? So why are these not all different numbers, tau I? But if you do the difference of two of such non-compact periods, the difference between them is a compact cycle. So the compact cycles, they have to give integers. because that's just the top logical argument that the remote service has to wind an integer number of times. So what I, to be more precise, what you really have is that this is equal to some fixed number plus possible integers bi. That's really honestly what's going on. So this bi, these integers bi that appear, they also have some interpretation, but they're not very important, but they have the interpretation as generalized theta parameters in the theory. But they don't really play a very important role. So if I would have been more precise, I would have written this. So if we want to find this full superpotential of these n equals 1 theories, what we need to do is we need to perturb this brain configuration, because this superpotential tells you what happens if you move away from the supersymmetric minima. So what we would like to see if, can we somehow perturb this configuration by turning on expectation values of these SIs away from the supersymmetric minima, and can we do that in such a way that we can use this brain configuration to compute this full superpotential W of SI. So we want to perturb it, we want to move away from the supersymmetric minima, otherwise there is no chance to generalize these configurations and to find this full superpotential, which again I'm not sure really whether it's physically that meaningful to look at that. But okay, let's do it anyway. It's interesting to try to think about the sort of things you get. So normally, or naively, one might think that if you want to move away from supersymmetric minima by turning on expectation values for these SIs, you might think that what, well, these SIs, they're chiral superfields, they somehow, chiral superfields are like holomorphic quantities. So perhaps what we should do is we should just find some holomorphic deformation of this 5 brain. But you can count the number of holomorphic deformations of this 5 brain, and there are no holomorphic deformations. That's roughly the same counting that you do when you, this is just a, we have a Riemann surface in 3 complex dimensions. So it's roughly a Riemann surface in a Calabi-Yau manifold. And if you count holomorphic deformations of Riemann surfaces in Calabi-Yau manifolds, then generically there are none. They are sort of generically rigid. There could be exceptions, but that's not going on here. So if you want to deform geometrically this 5-brain configuration to move away from the supersymmetric minima, we need to do a non-holomorphic deformation. Now, of course, once we do a non-holomorphic deformation, then you really, you know, then you, it's impossible to one would think to say anything useful, because there are infinitely many obvious non-holomorphic deformations. Just write down whatever you want. Draw any surface. But there are certain distinguished holomorphic deformations, non-holomorphic deformations. And in order to see what we need to do, we need to do the following. The clue is to look at some of these equations I wrote down before, which were the contour integrals around cycles of these distinguished one forms. So at the minima, these equations were true. So one thing that one might believe is that once we move away from these minima, we perturb the theory, we're no longer in a vacuum configuration. One thing one might believe is that these equations should still hold. Now if we ignore the first equation, because these are not, these do not require any holomorphic something, they're just an integral of a one form over one cycle. Now if you ignore this first line, and you just look at this curve in the WV plane, then in the WV plane, we have this one particular Riemann surface. You can see how many holomorphic deformations that has. That has precisely the right number of holomorphic deformations to describe the arbitrary expectation values of these glue ball fields. So as long as we restrict our attention to the WV plane, there would appear to be exactly the right number of holomorphic deformations of this surface to describe going the process of going away from the minima. But as I said before, the whole thing does not have holomorphic deformations. So the ansatz is going to be to try to find a holomorphic deformation of the curve in the WV plane so that these SIs take on arbitrary expectation values. And then, but then we still need to satisfy this equation one. But interestingly, this equation one has a unique solution for t given any underlying Riemann surface in the WV plane. So if you just make a, so we have this Riemann surface, it has a projection in the TV plane and one in the WV plane. This projection we deform in a holomorphic way, and then it turns out there is a unique way to deform it also in the TV direction, but that's going to be a non-holomorphic deformation. And this non-holomorphic deformation is completely determined by requiring that the coordinate that describes it, which is the coordinate T, has these integer periods, these contours. And this is a very simple geometric requirement because, as I said before, these NIs, they simply tell you how often this surface wraps around the M-theory circle. And that has to be an integer. So given some SIs, there is a holomorphic deformation in the WV direction, and then there is a unique non-holomorphic T. So that this integer is still an integer. So there is some very distinguished one form on this surface with integer periods. And the full proposal is that what you do is you take this M5 brain, you deform it holomorphically in WV, and then you define a non-holomorphic coordinate T by requiring that this integral is integer. And that yields some non-supersymmetric M5 brain configuration. It's non-holomorphic. You have explicitly broken supersymmetry. If you want to restore supersymmetry, you have to make it holomorphic and you go back to these supersymmetric configurations I described before. So this is the proposal. And actually, this proposal is supported by and provides some evidence for a field theory story, because there was a paper by Casciazzo, Seiberg, and Witten where they studied these field theories and their moduli space, and they discovered that in order to describe this theory in a very elegant way, what you really needed was a non-holomorphic one-form on the auxiliary Riemann surface, and they just used this non-holomorphic one-form as a tool to describe the various vacua and what was going on. And one of the crucial defining properties in their paper of this whole, of this one form, was that it needed to have integer periods. These integrals around one cycles needed to be integer. And here we see that these requirements that they just found by pure field theory considerations have a very simple geometric interpretation in this brain configuration. Because the one form, the non-holomorphic one form with integer periods, is precisely the one that gives you the embedding of the M5 brain. So can one compute the superpotential? So how do you compute the superpotential for such configurations? Well, suppose we have some, how do you compute the superpotential? Well, the calculation is as follows. We have some Riemann surface embedded in these three complex directions. And what you do is you take another reference Riemann surface. You find a three manifold whose boundary is the, consists precisely of these two Riemann surfaces. And then what you do is you do the integral of the holomorphic three form. This is a Calabi-Yau manifold. It's a trivial one. It's R5 times S1, but it's still a Calabi-Yau manifold. It has a holomorphic three form given here. And what you simply do is you integrate this holomorphic three form over this three manifold. That gives you, and the claim is that that gives you precisely the difference of the superpotential corresponding to this five brain configuration and this five brain configuration. And then you can manipulate this expression. It's slightly subtle, but at the end of the day, if you do all these manipulations, you find an answer for the superpotential, but now as a function of these SIs. So this is actually a non-holomorphic Riemann surface, but you do at the end of the day find a result for the superpotential. It's exactly the same answer as one gets from this matrix integral. So this is a proof to some extent that these non-holomorphic five-brain configurations give you precisely the same results as one gets from just from field theory. So that's a very good test that these non-holomorphic five-brains are indeed the right way to think about these theories. I'm still kind of surprised that you need to do this, go to explicitly non-holomorphic brain configurations in order to do this, but that's apparently what you need to do. And you can work out in an example, I'm just showing you to give an idea of the sort of things you get. If you just work this out in an example, I just do a mass-deformed UN theory, and you look at the five brain, the M5 brain configuration one gets, it's indeed an explicit non-holomorphic curve, which precisely becomes holomorphic when you're in the supersymmetric minimum. And there are several things that have a nice interpretation in this brain configuration. I already mentioned that the distinguished role a certain differential seems to be playing now has a simple geometric interpretation. And another thing that has a simple interpretation is, this was also found in another paper by Caciazzo, Douglas, Eiberg, and Witten, is that the effective action of these broken n equals 2 theories can be nicely written in terms of a very strange auxiliary n equals 2 superfield, which is written here. And this auxiliary n equals 2 superfield that just sort of fell out of the sky in their paper has as bottom component this glue ball field, as top component an integer, and then in the middle there is some fermion. But actually you can now see where this thing comes from. Namely, it turns out that this complicated field is simply the contour integral of an n equals 2 multiplet that exists in the six-dimensional theory. So in the six-dimensional theory, we have all kinds of, there's more supersymmetry. Some of these supersymmetries are broken. But if you look at one of the broken n equals 2 multiplets in the 2-0 theory, and you integrate this multiplet over one of the cycles to get a multiplet in four dimensions, then you find precisely this combination that they were using. So that simply, that seems to have some interpretation in terms of the Kaluza-Klein reduction of this five-brain theory. Good. So this shows you that certain things work very nicely. So there are certain physical puzzles that one might want to think about. So first of all, I think it would be an interesting calculation to try to work out in more detail the Kaluza-Klein reduction of this 2,0 theory on such a Riemann surface. Because although the deformations I was talking about were certain distinguished deformations of this configuration, they had certain nice properties, it's not at all clear that these are the only sort of light degrees of freedom that one can get. So if you would study the most general deformation of this five-brain configuration and see what it reduces to at low energy, it might shed some further light on the relevant degrees of freedom that play a role in these low-energy effective theories. And in particular, it might tell you whether these SIs are really the right low-energy degrees of freedom or whether there are other natural degrees of freedom that also emerge in this context that should be taken into account when one is studying these supersymmetric theories. And another puzzle is if you do this Kaluza-Klein reduction of this five brain and you study the Kähler potential of the theory, which is something one can in principle do also now. We have this five brain configuration. So another motivation to do this is this might give you some handle on the Kähler potential of these theories. But you find a funny result, namely if you do it completely naively, you find a result that does not look like the kinetic term of an n equals 1 theory. If you would have an n equals, I'm almost done. If you would have an n equals 1 theory, then the kinetic term should have only combinations of S and S bar, but there should not be SS and S bar combinations in your kinetic terms. So this tells you that this theory if you, is not compatible with n equals 1 supersymmetry. Therefore, the solution of to this is, although this is still this is work in progress, is that you have to actually to really make this into an okay theory, you have to also modify the space-time geometry. So we so far we're using S geometry R 5 times S1 with the standard metric and the standard holomorphic complex structure, but that does not give you a low-energy supersymmetric theory. So what you probably need to do is you probably need to modify the space-time geometry because so far in all everything I set up to here, the only thing that was ever needed was the complex structure, but nothing else. So in order to make this work, what one probably needs to do is to change the geometry of R5 times S1, and perhaps there are some indications that you probably have to make it non-Kähler. This is probably an example that fits nicely in this, all these recent developments of dualities in the presence of fluxes. And you can sort of dualize these brain configurations to other configurations that are more geometrical. And there you also see that these configurations have non-Kähler metrics and so on. So this seems to be an example where that is going to be important. Since I'm out of time, let me just stop here and summarize once more that this, the point of this, these calculations was to have a very simple unified picture of the matrix model and the gauge theorem all combined in a single M5 brain. And I think this is probably the simplest way you can understand these theories in string theory. So I think I'll stop here.
Are there any questions, comments?
Can one give a concrete answer in the case of SU5?
For which, what kind of concrete?
I mean, how it breaks.
Well, that's up to you. You know, you have to choose the superpotential, right?
That's completely up to us, yeah.
If you want to break if you want to break SU5 to SU3 times SU2 times U1, you can certainly do that by choosing a suitable superpotential and putting taking a certain configuration.
I thought there's nothing new in this direction. Yeah.
No. So for guts and so on, I'm afraid no.
Any more questions? Well, if not, let's thank Jan again. Our next speaker is Anastasia Volovich, and she will talk to us about Young-Mills amplitudes from string theory in twisted space.
Temos que apontar, anotar isto. Tens aí folhas?